Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for the season finale of season 14, The Reply Brief. This week was an emotional one where we had the conclusion of the season, we had some theories, and Bob really broke it down for us. This week, Janet is on assignment, so it's just Bob and I. But before we get into any of our listener questions, do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so. I don't think there's anything pressing going on right now. I'll be talking about what's coming up Sunday at the end of the show. But other than to say, expect for the next several weeks to we're going to have just kind of, I don't want to call them filler episodes. We're trying to be like interesting. And I think this week's episode is going to be very interesting. You guys really like it. But we have some content coming on, and that is because season 15 is in progress. So you guys just know what's going on all weekend. This weekend, I was out in the field tracking people down, recording interviews. But I'm still waiting on that police file. I don't know what's going to happen with that. I think I'm going to have to go to the DA's office to get it. So there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes right now, getting ready for season 15. So in the meantime, we're going to keep putting out content. We're still going to have Bob Mata's going to still come on. I've got a couple listeners that are working on the comparison episode of the two interviews for Jay and Jen. And I'll be doing other interviews along the way. So just know that. I know a bunch of people are they're chomping at the bit to get to the next season. I promise I am too. But we got to make sure we got all of our ducks in a row. And also the first week of April is a dark week for us. We're off. I'm going to be on spring break with the family that week. So I don't really want to start and then be off for a week anyway. So my hope is hopefully by the time we get back, in that second week of April, that we should be able to launch into the new season. But I'm also working with the person in prison to make arrangements to be able to talk to them on the phone to record some interviews. So there's just a lot happening to get us ready, but just know that that is happening. And other than that, I don't think we have any other major housekeeping. This, we'll start with you, Zach. So you went into the reply brief having had never really didn't know hardly anything about this case. And then you've been kind of immersed in it now for 20 weeks, of these episodes coming out, and it all concluded with this. So I kind of want to hear your thoughts on the finale episode and just in kind of your overall thoughts now that you've spent 5 months in the case, what you're feeling.
So I did something this week that I have not done in a professional setting yet. And I hate to say this, but it is the God's honest truth. I listened to about half of the other podcast that I was supposed to listen to and turned it off because I could no longer stomach it. It's something that I did not want to do, but I just could no longer. Everything I know, and at the point that they just continued to harp on the same issues over and over again that we've already negated and we've already kind of shown that they're fallacies, I just couldn't do it anymore. As far as that, the other podcast that we were talking about.
Okay.
Yours, I was very pleasant. It was very nice to hear. And I'm really happy that you kind of took that extra moment to address everything, not just the season, not just Brett and Alice, but kind of this whole idea that, these are real people. Every Truth and Justice season, every season we talk about, every episode is real people. And I feel like too many people kind of forget that sometimes, and it's hard.
It's weird for me that I wrote and recorded these episodes and put them out months ago, and then like they come back up and I re-listen to them to prepare for the follow-ups and kind of remembering the things that I said. But I'll say that finale episode was one I liked the way that first 5 minutes is one of my favorite 5 minutes that I've ever put together, if that makes sense, which obviously had nothing to do with the case, but it was just really kind of talking about the lessons of what I took away from this experience myself.
Yeah. And the ethics behind it. I mean, that I think that's a big part of this is really this season we explored the ethics behind true crime and what needs to be pushed out there. So moving into your episode, really hearing all the ideas and I didn't realize that, in your episode, you kind of broke down all the Ritz and McGillivray, like the issues that they've had as detectives. And to actually hear you break down each case and what was wrong with that moving forward really does kind of set up that whole idea that, like, maybe this isn't this grand conspiracy that Brett and Alice are trying to make it out to be. That, like, why would these guys do this? Well, clearly they've done it multiple times over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if you got that far into their episode or not, but part of what, it's just such an odd approach to me, because when I listened to theirs originally, so like I had mentioned on my episode, they talked about one of those cases and broke down the things that Ritz was accused of doing in that case. And so they share all that, and then they're like, this stuff's all terrible, but that's very different from it. It's not the same. It doesn't stoop to the level of what the people are accused. So like, and they still come back like it's a great, and all I was thinking was, you don't think the guy that did that, that suppressed the evidence and did all this shit that he did to get that conviction, you don't think that the same guy, even if that's all he did, you don't think that the same guy that did all that would then get a witness to lie? Like, I don't even understand the logic, but like when they say it, it's like so convincing the way they present it. And then you're like, wait, no, what you just told me is that he's a crooked cop. Mm-hmm. You just told me he's a crooked cop. And then follow it up with, but not that crooked. Yeah. And I don't, it frustrating.
Well, that's several aspects of this season. How many times did they go back to the cell phone? Like the cell phone, I mean, he spent another large portion of this episode trying to make you believe that the incoming calls can be tracked, just not precise location, but it doesn't mean, I mean, I was floored when he started going into that. Because we've been over this numerous times, and not just in this season. I know that, you know, we went over it two seasons ago or last, whatever season it was, the Pinyon Pines case, we went over it pretty in depth with the fact of that it can't be used for location basis, but they tried to still sway you saying that it can be, that it just can't be used for exact location. You know, it's just like the verbiage they use to try to continue to push their narrative and push it in the direction they want so that you believe what they're saying.
And I remembered when I listened back, when I had the aha moment that I kind of, for me, and I shared it on the show, when I realized, like, I got sucked into their trap along the way, which was talk about Asia, talk and talk and talk about Asia, argue about Asia, talk about the cell phones, on and on and on. Talk about that. I had that aha moment in this one when I realized, like, that's exactly what they wanted. Because then I realized, like, wait a minute, the most important part of this case clearly is Jay's story. Mm-hmm. They don't talk about that at all. In fact, they tell you not to worry about it, don't think about it. And the most critical elements of Adnan's alibi is track practice. They read his report and skipped the line where he said that he arrived on time and left on time. They took the line that said that Coach Tsai initiated the conversation and just completely lied and distorted it and said that Adnan started the conversation. But it's like the biggest key elements of the case that were the most important for anybody to under, whether you fall on the innocent side or the guilty side, that are the most important parts of it for you to fully understand this case, they didn't talk about them at all. And again, I'll say this, everybody's got their own opinions on their ethics and their morals, but I think they're very bright and they're probably very good in the courtroom, because they managed to, you know, I was going through this as a kind of a statement analysis, the whole thing, and I missed it. I spent the episodes arguing back with them about mm-hmm. Asia and about the cell phones and about that stuff when those don't matter. It was the entire thing was a distraction to get you to look over there instead of looking at Jay and Jen's stories and Adnan's alibi. That's what the entire thing was.
This has been a really interesting exercise in critical thinking and really trying to, you know, I really went into this open-minded and tried to see both sides, and there was several times early on where I was listening to them and I felt like what they were saying was very true, was very accurate, was really swaying me to believe what they were saying. But then the more we continue to break things down and the more you continue to expose what they were saying, I mean, it becomes truly disheartening. And that's why I said, like, I've turned podcasts off before for my own pleasure that I just wasn't interested in. But in a fact that this is like our job, I have never wanted to do that. I wanted to see it through. And I just got to a point where I could no longer listen to what they were saying and what they were spewing, because I knew it was so far off base and so far off what I believe at this point. And I'm happy that you were able to put this episode together. You know, essentially this episode was in three parts, and the way you broke it down was wonderful, not just for me, but I think a lot of listeners really enjoyed this episode.
Well, I appreciate that. And I really do. You know, we said at the beginning of the season, it was going to be kind of a thought experience for you, or experiment for you to go through this in this way. And it makes me, because, it, you know, certainly there's people that are, you know, that are like, well obviously Zach's going to agree with Bob. For anybody that knows us and most of our longtime listeners, no, that's not true. Zach will absolutely tell me he disagrees with me. That's why Zach is objective. He's subjective. And I wanted him to listen. So it makes me feel good to know that when you spent these episodes going through and hearing the facts broken down, and hear when they say a document says this, and then you hear it read from the document and hear the information, that it cemented the facts of the case in your mind so much that you couldn't even bear to listen to them anymore spew there. And what you missed was at the end of it was just theories that literally weren't based in fact at all. I mean, Alice really dug into what a horrible, rotten, evil person Adnan was, and that he was, you know, essentially Brett says that, you know, that Adnan, it wasn't premeditated. He wasn't planning to kill her. He was asking her to prom and to take him back. And when she said no, he flipped out. And Alice says basically the same thing, except for he knew that he was going to, that he was going to give her no choice, that it was, you either accept my offer or you're going to die. And then goes on to tell you how sociopathic Adnan is, that in his mind, it's justified that Hay chose to die. Like this whole horrific thing. And it's like, there wasn't one single, and I don't mean like incorrect facts. I mean, there was not one single fact in the theory. Nothing was based in evidence. It was just the story.
And they tried to touch on that early in this season. I don't remember what episode it was, but they tried to touch on that early in the season. They said that, like, because of Adnan's religion and his beliefs, that, you know, that women are second-class citizens and they look down on him, and that, and Hay was his possession. And I mean, they really tried to lean on that early in the season too, I felt.
Yeah. And it was a weird take too. Like Nick in the chat says, it's not premeditated, but Adnan called Jay the night before to plan it. And that's the thing. Like, if you're paying attention, their whole, like, it's crazy. They go on and on about how the way we know Adnan did this is because he bought that phone for the purposes of murdering Hay. He made the plans to get in Hay's car so he could murder Hay. Like, the phone and the car and the call to Jay was all that's how we know he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my final conclusion is it wasn't pre-planned. It's like, Yeah, another good point somebody made up here. I just want to point this out real quick. Shannon in the chat says, this made me doubt my own mind and scared me even more about a jury trial. And if this did nothing else, I think that hopefully this educates people. If you're sitting on a jury, if you have anybody that's going through a trial, anything, like, this is how it's done. This is why wrongful convictions happen. If you take a couple of very skilled prosecutors, they can take any set of facts. You heard it, especially if you listen to their series. You heard them completely spin a narrative and convince thousands of people that a man was guilty when you actually look at the facts, none of it was based in reality. It was all smoke and mirrors. And it's scary. Yeah.
It is scary. It's really scary.
And with that, before we go too much longer, we should probably get into, we've got a handful of listener questions to get through.
So before we do that, I just want to say one thing. I want to say, Bob, thank you. Thank you from me. Thank you from the listeners. There's a lot of people out there that truly appreciate that you took the time and effort in these past 20 weeks to set the record straight and to do the best you could to tell the truth and provide justice for not only Adnan, but for Hay.
Well, I do very much appreciate that. And I appreciate y'all that came along the journey with me. It means a lot to me.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Imagine what you would do with just one extra hour in a day. I think about this a lot. For me, the answer is simple. I would actually read for pleasure. I just never seem to have enough time to read, and I would love a free hour. And that's the thing. A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but the question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. I'm a firm believer of the benefits of therapy in so many aspects of life, and this is definitely one of them, learning how to prioritize and manage time. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you're not meshing well, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/truth today for 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/truth for 10% off your first month.
So let's get into these listener questions. Daniel says, how have we gone all these years? And the fact that Hay said, I'm going to meet Don, has not been a much bigger discussion.
I mean, it has been in the right circles. But the thing, I want to point out that because we have a witness that says Hay said she was going to meet Don, doesn't necessarily mean that's what she was going to do. Doesn't even necessarily mean that she said it. It's, but it is in evidence. It is what we have. And the problem with this case is that you have two camps that are dug in pretty deeply. And I've tried really hard to not be in a camp, to try to stay objective, to try to stay neutral. So I can see, I need to be able to see the evidence through without looking through a lens. But a lot of people on both sides look through a lens. So the people on the Adnan is innocent side will lean on that, but it depends which lens they're looking for. Think back to the West Memphis 3 is a good example of this. There are people there's the people that think the West Memphis 3 are guilty, and then there are the people that think the West Memphis 3 are innocent. But of the people that think the West Memphis 3 are innocent, we found out during season 5, there are people that are convinced that John Mark Byers killed them. There are people that are convinced that Terry Hobbs killed them. There are people that are convinced that a serial killer, a truck driver, killed them. And what I found is the dissection of that side of the camp can be very vicious too, because people get set into their own theories and they get locked into them and they don't want to see anything else. And so that's why the conversation hasn't been more prevalent, is because people will point it out that she said it. And the people that think Adnan's guilty and have that set in stone for them, they're always going to say, well, Debbie had the wrong day, or she's lying, whatever. They'll come up with any excuse for you to throw that away. On the Adnan is innocent side, you have people you have camps that think that Don is the killer. You have people that think that Jay is the killer, or Jay and Jen together, or Alonzo Sellers, or Bilal, or a serial killer. And for those, you have the same thing on that side, right? So you have the people that are convinced in their mind that Don certainly had nothing to do with this. So then they will find reasons why she didn't say that, and then you have, there's a problem with conflict. There's certainly conflicts with this. And that's why I tried to stress so much. So what I said at the end, there was nothing more than a theory. It's the best theory I can come up with based on the facts. Doesn't mean it's right. Doesn't mean it's even the best theory. It's the best theory I can come up with, because I recognize that there are other conflicts, right? So she said, she tells Debbie she's going to go see Don. She had to pick up her niece or her cousins, and she didn't show up for that. Well, when would she have had time to meet? There's a lot going on there that just questions that are still out there. I know that's a long response to your question, but I think that has a lot to do with it.
Well, even for that matter, I think you're very open to the idea that, like, the time cards are questionable, but if they come through and are reliable, you are willing to accept that.
Absolutely. Like, if what I've said from the beginning is these things, like, it was a disservice to Don that these things weren't investigated properly, because we would, because if he's innocent, we wouldn't be having this discussion if it was proven, but they were just left out there, and the time cards were obtained in a shady way. You know, they got their time. Think about how this is how this goes down, right? So Yurik, the prosecutor, gets a hold of Lens Crafters and subpoenas, "I want the timesheets for Don, just so we can check that box and prove that he was working." They send him the timesheet, and he wasn't working. Most prosecutors would be, or most attorneys, investigators would say, "Uh-oh, well, yeah, we got a big problem here. He lied about it. I'm about to try this guy, and this guy lied about his alibi." He then gets on the phone to Luxottica or Lens Crafters, talks to somebody off record. It's not recorded. We don't have notes from it or anything. We only know the phone call happened because it's referenced in the next production. But he gets on the phone and has them start digging in deeper. And then that's when they find the second time card that comes to light. So, like, there's all these questions out there. But certainly, if somebody were, like, to go and investigate and they could see, nope, this was clocked in by him, or there's some witness out there that's like, no, I did, I worked with him that day. You know, do not get it twisted and think that, like, for the people that say, "I'm accusing Don," I'm certainly not. Yeah, it's just, as I said, a theory is not the end of an investigation. A theory is the midpoint of an investigation. You gather the facts, form a theory, then further investigate it. The problem with Don, the Don situation, is it was not further investigated. So we still have unanswered questions about it. But to your point, Zach, if it came back, they're like, nope, he absolutely has an alibi. Like, great, cross him off the list. That theory's bunk. Let's move on to the next one.
Yep. Speaking of theories, Solomon has a theory. They say, "I feel a meeting at a construction site or place under renovation would more accurately explain the diamond pressure marks on Hayes' shoulder rather than laying face down in a motel."
Yeah, so to be clear, in my theory, I don't think that she was face down. I think I said in the episode, I'm not even sure she was buried that night. My theory is that she was left there in the hotel, and then they would have returned to pick her up to get her car and her body out of there. And again, I can't stress enough, if that's what happened. Because of those double diamond marks are the reason why I said that I think it's likely that her body was laying face down in the back of a truck or in the back of a work van or something like that, for a period of time when the lividity fixed before she was then buried. I think the priority would have been, based on my psychological profile of the scene, the priority would have been to, you know, whoever killed her, the offender, has a connection to the location where she was killed, so they needed to get her body and her car away from there. The next step is, now let's conceal the body and make sure that people don't think she was murdered. People think that she just left town.
Nicole asks, "Will there be a follow-up Instagram Live with Rabia and Colin?"
I think so. So when we talked to Colin about it, before we did the last live, he said he would definitely do it, but he was, like, swamped at work. So we were going to circle back to it. I'll have to talk to Rabia and Colin about it and see if they want to do it again. I don't want to commit for him because I don't know. But based on our previous conversations, yeah, that's something that can happen.
So Crystal has a comment based on your last live with Rabia and says she gave new information and possible theories, like the body being dumped over the barrier and seller seeing it or finding it and then moving it deeper in the woods so he could spend his own time with the body before reporting it. You say you needed time to process it all and mull it over before you could comment on any of it. Can you comment now?
Yeah, I can comment. Any theory has its own merits till it's proven or disproven, right? For me, I believe Robbie had said that there was like a profile or some kind of investigator that had suggested that theory. I can't see it. I've thought about it a lot, and I've tried to look at the evidence that we have, and it doesn't make sense to me that if that was the case, if the body was just dumped and then Sellers finds it and does whatever he's going to do, I don't think that ends with him burying the body, and I certainly don't think that it ends with him burying the body and then, air quotes, discovering the body, right? I mean, if he's the one that buried it, and it's not that this doesn't ever happen, it just doesn't seem to add up to me that the intent of the burying of the body would be so that the body's not found. So it would be odd to me that the person who spent all that time, effort, and risk to conceal the body would then just turn around and then point the police right to it. You know, because as we've talked about before, there's a number of reasons why people bury bodies and try to totally conceal bodies. And one is so that you don't know a murder happened at all. And another one sometimes is to try because of there's forensic evidence, right? So the offender's concerned that they have DNA, fingerprints, whatever, there's forensic evidence that they've left on the body. So in this case, you would think that if Sellers was the one to bury the body, that it would be the latter, right? That he would be burying the body because whatever he had touched, done whatever, he would have been afraid that if the body's found, then there his evidence would be on it. So then I don't understand why it doesn't add up to me that then later he's like, no, let's point them to it and see if they find the evidence. So basically that theory in my, it's simply only my opinion just doesn't seem to have the legs.
And that makes sense to me as well. So Carrie has a question about your theory about the hotel. Did Hay have to work or any other obligations after picking up her cousin? I say this because it would be a very short rendezvous to warrant a hotel room.
So she had to work, I believe, at 6 o'clock that night. And that's part of that conflict we were talking about earlier. But a part of the issue there is we have so many unknowns. And part of it is that everybody wants to assume that because Hay was a responsible kid, that she would never, and that's what we always hear, right? She would never not pick up her cousins on time. And the truth of the matter is we don't know that with anybody. Like I have some real responsible kids that absolutely make, you know, have blown off responsibilities in the past. And I'm not saying she would, I don't know, but there's a possibility of that. Another possibility is if it was, you know, she didn't have to work till six, if they went, met at a hotel room, got checked in. And again, I keep saying this, can't stress enough. These are just possible hypotheses, right? That we could be dealing with. They went like, get checked in. I got to run and drop my cousins off. Then I'll be back, you know, and they'd still have a couple of hours just to spend together if that was the case. And then something goes wrong during that time. Who knows? I mean, there's just a lot of there. I acknowledge there is certainly conflict there, but there's too many unknowns for me to rule it out.
Lori says, I think it's possible she was strangled, then suffocated. Evidence on strangulation from the autopsy is weaker than the typical strangulation. It's noted the hyoid was dislocated and there was some bruising. This leads me to think it was a failed strangulation. The killer started down that path, but then didn't have the strength to keep it up for the length of time needed. This explains the lack of damage seen in the typical strangulation. So they moved on to suffocation. I think this could explain Bob thinking it was a suffocation, whereas the autopsy concluded it was a strangulation.
Yeah, and there was another comment on there where somebody said something similar, and I actually had a discussion on the fan page with some people about this, and even some medical professionals, because people point out that I said, I don't think that she was strangled, and they said, her hyoid bone was dislocated, and then the ME that testified at trial said the hyoid bone was broken. But the autopsy says it's dislocated, and they said there was some like minor bruising. It's not even really visible. I think it was more subcutaneous on the skin, on the neck, and then there's the petechia in the eyes. But the petechia could come just from normal decomposition, so we can't be sure that that's what that means. But it was a worthwhile conversation because there is some evidence of manual strangulation with the hyoid being dislocated and some bruising. But then, so I was open to hearing that, but then I think back to like other cases that I've read autopsies for and looked at the case files on where there's been strangulation. We don't see with Hay the level of injury that you normally see. It, definitely not from a conscious, you know, I've talked about several times about the scratch marks, you know, if If someone's strangling you with two hands, that means their hands aren't free, but yours are. And what you're going to, anybody, Nat, is going to be just desperately trying to get those hands off. So we don't see that. And that's why I said, whatever happened, I think she was unconscious when it happened, because there's no evidence that she was clawing at trying to stop the person from strangling her. But also, you see, I mean, I've seen like just distinct, I even consulted, I have Dr. Warner Spitz's book out here, the medical legal handbook out there, and, you know, the textbook that MEs study from. And I went through pictures and stuff. And I mean, you deep, dark bruises. I mean, sometimes you can see the perfect imprint of the hands and the fingers when someone is strangling. We don't see that. So you can say, yeah, there was some bruising, but it's not the kind of bruising we expect to see. The hyoid was dislocated, but it wasn't broken. And there's no defensive wounds showing that she was trying to stop it from happening. And then another thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is strangling someone is not like on the movies. It doesn't take seconds to strangle someone. It takes minutes to strangle someone. I mean, you have to cut off their airway. And so think about this. Like, now, obviously, there's like free divers that have trained themselves to hold their breath for 10, 15 minutes at a time. But a normal person, you know, you can go without breathing for 2-3 minutes before you pass out. And at that point, you're still not dead. There's another 2 solid minutes before you're actually brain dead, before the oxygen supply has been cut off for long enough to make you brain. And that takes a lot of pressure to make that happen. So when you know that, so say 4 minutes, like generally from start to finish, strangling somebody with an immense amount of pressure, I certainly do not see the types of injuries on hay that indicate that somebody did that for 4 minutes. You know, and you'd have to imagine that whole time she's just sitting there with her hands down, and they're supposed to be in a car too, remember? So, you know, she's going to be, you know, trying to get away. There's a lot that should be happening there. There should be so many injuries if this was a manual strangulation that happened in a car. And even if it was a manual strangulation that happened in a house or a hotel room or wherever, the injuries around the throat to me should be much more intense. So as far as the question there, I think you may be right. It could have been someone attempted to strangle or started to and changed their mind. They were either very, and I think we kind of summarized that, but I think it went on to say, you know, maybe it's somebody that didn't have the hand strength or whatever to do it. It could be somebody who is very timid, right? Killing someone is a big deal. It's not, again, not like on TV. It's not something people take lightly. Even murderers, they don't take it lightly. Most people, it's not taken lightly. So it could just be too timid. Maybe they started to strangle her and were just, they couldn't do it, and then ended up backing off and putting a pillow over her face. I don't know. Who knows? But to me, I cannot conclude, and I'll acknowledge a medical examiner did conclude this, and I'm certainly not that, so take that for what it's worth. But I can't conclude from what I've seen that she was killed strictly by manual strangulation. I just don't think that's possible.
Moving on, Lisa has kind of a question in theory about Don. It says, we know that Don waited hours to talk to the police after they initially tried to contact him, which is suspicious. Could he have heard from someone else that Hay was missing, and then knowing he was supposed to meet up with her that afternoon, realize he didn't have an alibi, and possibly knowing how corrupt the Baltimore police was, asked his mom to fake a time card? I do understand the hotel theory and that it would make sense regarding moving the car, but I have a hard time getting past the fact that Hay didn't pick up her cousin or make arrangements for the pickup.
Yeah, so that goes back to that conflict that we had earlier. As far as the theory about Don, I mean, who knows? But this is one thing you have to keep in mind. Don didn't live in Baltimore County. Hay didn't go to school in Baltimore. Don didn't live in Baltimore. He lived in Bel Air. Hay didn't go to school in Baltimore City. She went to school in Baltimore County, and it was Baltimore County Police Department that contacted him. So it's not, I don't know that he would have suspected that this is the corrupt Baltimore City Police Department working on this, because first of all, it wasn't. And I don't know, that just seems like a big jump to me, but who knows? You know, you get a call from the police and you get worried about it, and so therefore, let's fake an alibi. that you don't present, you know, they don't present real. I guess they do present it because he does say that he was working after on his third interview and then they went and got the time card.
Well, and the listener says that they understand the hotel theory and the car, but have a hard time getting past the fact that Hay didn't pick up her cousins. But I don't think that's really part of it. If Hay had planned to just have an afternoon delight and move on with her day, you know, maybe she still thought mm-hmm. she had time to get it. So just because she didn't make arrangements to pick up her cousins, maybe she thought she was going to have time.
It could be. Again, there's all those unknowns there. That we just don't know because the cousins didn't be picked up till 3:15. We don't know where any of this happened. You know, and it might not have been a hotel. It could have been anywhere. That's just the thing that makes the most sense to me based on geography. And also keep in mind that like, cause other people have said, seems like a big pain in the ass to go through the trouble of, you know, renting a hotel room if you only have a few minutes to spend in it. But I mean, teenagers will find places. To do these types of things. And we know, based on what we heard from, I believe it was Hay's friends, it might have even been from Hay's diary, that is something they did when she was with Adnan, that they would, you know, they would get a hotel and go, I don't want to get any more graphic than that, but I'm certain they didn't need it for a super long time.
Fair enough. Moving on, Keith has three questions. The first one is, do you think the flower paper was from the rose that Jawan described Adnan giving Hay at work a few weeks before her death?
Maybe. I mean, I think that was around Christmas time when that happened. So it would have been, you know, a few weeks before, but the car was kind of a mess. Could be, who knows? I mean, the whole point was with the rose, it's an easy mistake to make. Robbie made it. In her book, like, because somebody, of course, somebody on the guilty side is like, there was a rose. Look, it's right here in Rabia's book that they found the rose in the car. Da da da. Because, and the reason for that is because that's what the report said. It said rose and baby's breath. It said rose and baby's breath floral paper or whatever. It's easy to read that and think that means there's a rose and baby's breath wrapped in floral paper in the back of the car. You have to go through then. The next step and look when the evidence tech was testifying and he was asked, was there a flower? No, there wasn't. Was there ever a flower in that paper? I don't know. Could there have ever been? Maybe there was some kind of residue on it that maybe could have come from, like, that's what the testimony is. There's no question here for the people that are still trying to argue there was a rose. The weird part about it was, is after all the evidence we do have and all of the work and investigation that was done leading to this point, they both based their theory off of it. Like also that they didn't bother to like chase down and confirm and make sure that it was true. I mean, I believe Brett's exact words were the rose seals the deal for me. That's how I know he's guilty. That's how we know he did it. And that was a gamble that didn't pay off because you're saying that the thing that convinced you he's guilty is a thing that doesn't exist.
I think that makes it, it's that Hollywood ending, like it, there was the rose. That was the final piece of evidence. That's what they're trying to sell it as.
Yeah. And I'll point out too, I'm not just talking out of my ass here. I'll quote Brett and Alice, what they say repeatedly on their show. They know this at trial, the best story wins. They know that. And I've said that in our previous seasons. I said, it all comes out that you really need to look at closing arguments because the jury's going to hear weeks and weeks and weeks of testimony and evidence. And it's not like on TV. It's actually quite boring most of the time. But then at the end, they get to tell their story and the best story wins. And that terrifies me about these two is because they told a very convincing story that was completely void of evidence.
Keith's second question, and it's more of a statement, is Jay never claimed to do anything that actually helped Adnan. Never helped bury the body, didn't pick him up, just followed him around in a second vehicle. It's nonsense.
Yeah, one thing I've said from the Jump Street was, why would there be a come get me call? Why would Adnan call Jay and say, drive here, put more attention in this public parking lot to the fact that there was a murder, just to follow him to a different place? in a real world circumstance, the call would have been, meet me at the park and ride, not come meet me at Best Buy, look at the body. But to be fair, in one of the versions of Jay's story, he says he helped bury the body. But in most of the versions, he didn't drag the body. He didn't dig the hole. He didn't drive the car. He wouldn't touch her car. He wouldn't touch her body. He's just along for the ride the whole time. So essentially, the only reason that Adnan needed him at all was for a ride.
Keith's last question is, what are your thoughts on Brett and Alice criticizing anyone who put forth theories about Don, but then they turn around and make a detailed and slanderous accusations against the person who has had his conviction overturned?
That is the ultimate irony, and I'm glad some people pointed that out, because again, just like I said they would, that, you know, people have come out of the woodwork again on the other side. How dare you accuse Don? That's the if you want to really be objective, first of all, Don and Adnan are the same. They are both unindicted, innocent citizens, both of them. Adnan's conviction has been overturned. So know that. So anything you say about Don, anything you say about Adnan, it's the same. Neither of them are convicted of this crime. Then go listen to their theory about Adnan, their theory. When they tell you this is what happened, and the depths they go into to tell you that he did it, then go listen to my theory about Don. And listen for the differences. In my theory, and I get there's people that are like, you shouldn't be accusing. Again, there is a big difference between accusing and saying that this is a theory. I must have said 15 times during that this is just a theory. That's all this is. This is unproven. I'm just saying, based on these facts, this seems like a reasonable scenario to me. But it should be further investigated. But yeah, the people that are so mad for anything that I've said about Don have no problem with them accusing an innocent man of murder, because that's what they did. Adnan is an unindicted citizen.
Nick says, Brett and Alice say we know Adnan and Jay were together because of the Nisha call, but wasn't the come get me call after that? And why would Jay call Jen when he was sitting at her house still?
It depends, Nick, on which version of reality you're living in. So, according to Jay, the come get me call didn't come until after 3:40. According to Jen, the come get me call didn't come till between 3:45 and 4:15. She knows that because right after Jay left, he got the call, he left, she left and picked up her parents. She knows what time she picks up her parents. The Nisha call came in at 3:32. So, if you look at the actual evidence, you're exactly right. The Nisha call came in before the come get me call. But everybody on the guilty side knows that they have to move the time of that call for anything to make sense. So they moved it. The state moved it to 2:36, which we know isn't true. And so then now people are trying to move it to the 3:15 call in order to put it before the Nisha call. But Jay never said that's when it happened. And we've proven without question that that's impossible. Because, and then why would he call Jen when he's sitting at Jen's? I don't know. How did he receive a call on Jen's landline when he wasn't at Jen's? You remember that timeline? He left Jen's, then the come get me call came after he left, but it came into Jen's landline. So again, like, what version of reality are you living in when this happens? But one thing I can tell you for sure, even if the 3:15 was the come get me call, we've proven without question, you can't get that call on the tower on the west side of town by Best Buy at 3:15, drive over to the east side of town to the park and ride and drop the car off, and then be back on the west side at 3:32. When Nisha calls, there was a 3:21 call also where Jay called Jen, presumably before he got to the trunk pop. So you have 11 minutes to do all of that driving to make that happen. So none of it makes sense.
And our last question comes from Richard. Are you still going to have Bob Mata on to talk about this case?
Yes, absolutely. Bob is going to come on. I talked to Bob last night. He has listened to everything. He's listened to all of season 14. He's listened to the prosecutors. We need to hash out exactly. He said, you know, his problem is he didn't take notes while he was doing it. So he's got to, he asked if anybody like on our page has like a list of kind of conflicts. I know somebody, Tiffany, I think was working on that. The different things that the prosecutor said that we proved to be inaccurate based on the records. So if anybody does finish that, we can send that to him. I also want to talk to him about I don't want to have a debate really about Brett and Alice. I just want to, it seemed like from what I've seen on social media that Bob kind of sounds like he says he's on the fence and maybe he leaned a little more guilty. I want to have a discussion with a person that I trust to be objective, subjective, and honest that has a different viewpoint than me so we can have a dialogue. That's all I ever wanted from Brett and Alice. Okay, you think he's guilty? Let's talk about it. Tell me why, and I'll tell you why I disagree, and maybe maybe one lands on the other side, or maybe we agree to disagree. That's all I ever wanted. That's what I'm hoping to get out of Bob. And so we're working on that, but I do have something for you. As I mentioned, the housekeeping at the beginning, and we've got to get some episodes in here while we're prepping for season 15. And so for this week, you're going to hear from Bob Mata on Sunday. So while he wasn't quite prepped and ready to do the Adnan Syed one yet, I did get Bob on for the patrons on Monday. They got a sneak peek of it because they got to join the live stream while we recorded it. But I had an hour and 35 minute discussion with Bob Mata about the Delphi case, which if anybody that is not aware, Bob is deeply rooted. Like he's been to every hearing. He knows, you know, he's been there, boots on the ground for that case. So I had Bob on to talk about Delphi. That episode is going to go out on both feeds, Patreon and the main feed, on Sunday. And for you patrons, if you didn't catch the live on Monday, you'll also get the video version of that on Sunday too. So you're going to hear from Bob this Sunday. Coming up next week, I have a couple of listeners that, remember I told you I wanted to put together a side-by-side where we have it in one place where you can hear how Jay and Jen's interviews fit together as far as them describing events. And got a couple of listeners that have been working really hard on that. One of them's an audio engineer. The other one's just a great researcher and writer. They've been picking apart those interviews and editing together so you can hear in those interviews, which, you know, Brett and Alice said, that's the damning part, is that Jay's first interview and Jen's interview fit so perfectly together. So you're going to hear, this is what Jen said about this thing. This is what Jay said about it. This is what Jen said. This is what Jay said. We'll have that out for you next week. And if you have anybody else you want me to interview, let me know between now and then. But I'm trying to keep these episodes between now and when we launch season 15 to interviews, just because I don't have to take two, three days to research and write something. I can record the interview, get it out, get it edited, and I can keep working on the new case. So that's where we're going to go. I see a Susan Simpson in there. I'll reach out to Susan and see if she's up for it. With that, and I do want to shout out Caroline and Rachel. Those are the two listeners that have been busting their asses getting this episode together for you guys for next week. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. Bob Mata has a long one, hour and 35 minutes, all about Delphi. And I could have listened to Bob for 2 hours more. But that's where we wrap things up. And with that being said, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for joining the live. All of you guys participating. We love you all. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth, Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.